Hello and welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns. I'm Peter Lavelle. Here we discuss some real news. Macron, Cameron, and NATO are doubling down on Ukraine. And are anti-Israeli protests on campuses significant? How do they compare with previous bouts of student activism? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And in Marrakesh, we have Martin Jay. He's an award-winning journalist and commentator. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with George in Budapest. There's a pattern here developing, George. Every time the president of France, Emmanuel Macron, speaks to The Economist, he causes a lot of mischief, okay? And he shatters that claim that NATO is completely lockstep unified, because every time he speaks to The Economist, he gets a lot of other NATO members, important ones like the UK, that disagrees with him. So what did he say this time? The two major takeaways were, and this is about the introduction of French troops or NATO troops. It's never really clear to me. The translator should make that clear, but he doesn't. So NATO troops or French troops would enter Ukraine if Ukrainian lines were breaking. Well, they are breaking, okay? The second one is if you give requests. So I have to request for assistance. I just have to wonder, does Macron have his phone disconnected? Because I think they would have called by now. George, what do you draw from this? We'll talk about David Cameron, who should have disappeared from public life forever, but he's back. So let's talk about Macron first.
Well, you're absolutely right, Peter. It's a very head-scratching experience one has when one listens to these interviews with Macron, because he expounds at great length without ever really explaining what he means. So he declares that, oh, well, he wants this introduction of, as you say, it's not clear whether it's French troops or NATO troops. I assume he would like NATO troops, but as a backup, just in case he doesn't get the NATO troops, then he just says French troops. Well, because he wants to create strategic ambiguity, so that he wants Putin to be uncertain in his own mind what he wants to do. And then he says, and then he justifies that by saying, oh, yeah, but, you know, we've been putting all these limits on what we've done in the past, but Putin has no limits on what he does, which, of course, is complete nonsense, because Putin has shown himself to be extremely limited in his goals in Ukraine. And then he says, as you say, well, if Ukrainian lines are breaking, which what does he mean by that? They're breaking now. Or, as you say, is that if Zelensky asks for French troops, and he said, but so far he hasn't asked. Okay, well, how about tomorrow? He's going to ask. What are you going to do then? So he thinks that he's being very cute here, thinking, oh, well, I'm creating strategic ambiguity. You know, Putin now doesn't know what I'm going to do, and that's a good thing for us. But it really isn't, because now he's now said it several times, and he's going to be eventually called up on it. You can't just keep bluffing without getting called up on your bluff.
Exactly.
You know, strategic ambiguity and strategic confusion are two different things. Martin, I think, you know, we've seen enough of Hollywood films. I mean, if you go into a bar and you want to pick a fight, you better not be bluffing. You better be prepared to fight. And I think that this is the confusion that Macron is sending out, not only within the NATO world, but addressing the Russians. It seems like confusion, not ambiguity to me.
Yeah, I think, wasn't it Macron himself, as you said a couple of years ago when describing NATO, that it was brain dead? I think this is really a brain dead narrative now that he's indulging in. And, you know, these sort of speeches, these sort of chats that he has with journalists, you know, it's sort of call center journalism, isn't it? You know, you have to publish what he says if you're The Economist or you're... He used to take out full page editorials in The Telegraph, in the print edition, you know, not so long ago, because he really believes that he is a world leader. He really believes that he is an icon in the Anglo-Saxon Western world. And of course, he isn't. And that's really the problem. You know, and that's why you need to keep doing this, because it's an idea that he has, that he's a world leader and he has that kind of influence. And what's really going on here? You know, is this really serious? You know, you mentioned ambiguity. I think there's a lot of smoke and mirrors here, and not really much of it makes sense. Talking about the Russians breaking through the Ukrainian lines, that would be the Ukrainian lines that don't exist, because the Ukrainians took all the money from the Americans to build this so-called Maginot Line, but they didn't actually build it in the end. So what's the, what's that? You know, breaking through Ukrainian lines. But look, you know, what's really going on? I've written in my editorials, and I've hinted before on this show about these Macron polemic, you know, verses, that this isn't really about stirring up a lot of shit. And what he really wants to do is scaremonger a number of EU member states, in particular Hungary, into thinking that, look, if you don't sign off on the $100 billion package that we've got in the pipeline from NATO, you know, and you block that, which is going to be a massive failure for Western elites if it doesn't go through, if you don't sign off on that, then we can resort to this, and you being in the region, you know, you being on the border, you're going to be really at the, one of the countries that's going to be hit the hardest if we start talking
This is not a message to the Russians. It's a message to other NATO members. And George, I mean, it's also public opinion that he needs to look like a leader or something like that, you know, channeling his inner Bonaparte, George. I mean, is this what he's doing? I mean, they both are small men. I mean, that works, at least in here. Okay, George.
No, I think so. But I think also... and I think you, Peter, alluded to it the other day. There is a desire on the part of Europe's leaders, and that, you know, obviously includes Macron, but Ursula von der Leyen, Josep Borrell, to crack down on European freedom of speech as much as possible, and generally freedom in Europe. And what better opportunity is there than we're in a state of war? And Annalena Baerbock has already said, you know, we are at war with Russia. So there is a vested interest among Europe's elites to whip up war fervor to justify, you know, the various crackdowns on social media, on free expression that they already have in the pipelines. I mean, we know about the Digital Services Act that the EU has adopted. They're constantly applying pressure against the social media. This is the best opportunity for it. So, you know, there is obviously that aspect of it. But Macron's problem is still, if you have now said this over and over again, and at some point you are going to be on the hook. Zelensky is going to come to you, and, you know, all the various policymakers, all the think tanks are going to come to you and say, well, this is the opportunity. You know, we've got a real problem on our hands. And this is something Josep Borrell said again the other day, if Russia wins in Ukraine, then we are all under threat. All of Europe is under threat. All of our security is under threat. We cannot allow Russia to win. So you've said all this, well, you're pretty much coming up to the brink of saying, well, now we're at war. And then what are you going to do? You're going to start mobilizing the country, you're heading towards disaster.
One has to wonder if French generals would even heed the call, to be honest with you, okay? Martin, let's go to the UK. David Cameron, the return of the walking dead, as it were, as foreign secretary. His government took a shellacking in local elections, and he's saying that, you know, it's something like, you know, a guaranteed £3 billion a year for Ukraine, ad infinitum here. I wonder why they lost those elections. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, they lost those elections because hardly anybody, even Tory supporters, Conservative supporters, have any confidence in this government to win the next general election. You know, we're all basically preparing for a Labour victory, which is a disaster in itself, because I don't think the Labour Party are even...
Well, at least on the issues that we're concerned about, yeah, I don't see a difference.
Yeah, I know. So, I mean, so for David Cameron to sort of spout this, you know, it's very difficult to think about David Cameron without thinking of that terrible article that somebody wrote about him, where at Eton he apparently did something quite beastly with a pig's head. But moving away from such sexual acts, I think he's really also counting his own days. And he knows that in 6 months' time he's going to be out of a job, so it really doesn't matter what he said. Obviously, he's going to support Biden and this idea to the hilt. You know, the, he's just put gone on the record as saying, you know, the idea of French troops or NATO troops in Ukraine is completely out of the question because that would just spark a world war. But he doesn't come up with any alternative plan. It's nothing really concrete except signing off more and more money. And I think that's, as you, to answer your question, I think people are tired of these policies in the UK, which don't make any sense, which don't add up at all, geopolitically, internationally, or even domestically, you know. And I think the question we should be asking ourselves is, in the UK and in the European Union and in America, are we on the cusp of some massive political sea change? You know, is there a new generation of politicians now going to be ushered in? What's happening in the UK, and you mentioned the local elections, is that it seems to be a period of the little man. So we're going to have, I think, lots more independent candidates, you know, and if enough of them, like George Gallery, are able to actually direct media towards a more common sense narrative on Ukraine and Israel, you know, something quite seismic could happen in the next 6 months.
Well, I mean, at least in sentiment, I agree with you, but, you know, I'm going to go to George, who is a consummate pessimist here. And even as the promotion for this program on this channel, George repeats the words, "We have the tools." They have the tools, George. They basically have all the cards in the deck. Social media censorship, shutting down venues. There was a very famous, Palestinian surgeon that is, you know, just basically been made persona non grata for wanting to go to France. And then they told him, "You can't speak." And then they put him on the late flight. They put him on an early one. It's really nasty. These people are really nasty, and they want to show their power. Intimidation and violence is their strongest but last card to play.
Yeah, absolutely right. And the other day, I saw a story. Oh, some German politician has been attacked, physically attacked. Or, you know, he was a Green. One was a Green politician. The other one, Social Democrat Party. Immediately, German media. This is the alternative for Deutschland supporters behind it. We've been waiting for this party to be banned in Germany. You know, whether is it because they're pro-Russian? Is it because they're a threat to democracy? Is it because they're against immigrants? Is it because they're pro-Nazi? But it's coming. So I think that's how you deal with the opposition. You just accuse them of being against democracy. But going back to Britain, Keir Starmer will, without doubt.
Hold that thought, George. We have to go to a hard break, and after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns. I'm Peter LaBelle here, and we're discussing some real news. All right, George, you were finishing up your answer in the first part of the program about dissent and the tools of the state. Keep going.
Yes, when you have Keir Starmer will, without question, before the end of the year, be prime minister. Not only can we not expect any change when it comes to foreign policy of the UK, but it's quite likely that it'll mean the de facto reemergence of Tony Blair. And Tony Blair is, you know, absolutely front and center with globalists, with obviously the EU leaders, and you know he's the interventionist par excellence. I mean, I think it's quite likely they'll be reliving the glory days of the late 90s and the early years of this of the century. This kind of interventionist mentality will continue. Now the question is, how does the public respond to that? And now we've seen in the UK, we've seen in France, we've seen in the United States, there is real protest. And what's different about these protests as opposed to the fraudulent, bogus protests of 2020, the summer of George Floyd, is that these protests are about something. They're against intervention on behalf of Israel. They're against this unconditional support for horrific atrocities, and they're demanding that the institutions distance themselves, divest from Israel. That's something specific. That's not something, hey, I'm against institutionalized white racism. You know, I'm against the police. you know, which is just nonsense and a complete, just would be pointless self-indulgence. So if you've got a movement that is about something, well, that's going to be quite interesting. We'll see, because then that's going to, we'll put pressure on governments and may lead to some sort of change.
It's interesting. I mean, if you look at the student protests across the Western world, I mean, obviously it's the issue of Israel's genocidal acts against the Palestinians and Gaza is in play. But I think in a broader sense, and it's something that we've talked many times on this program about, is this is turning into just an anti-establishment movement, because particularly when you look at young people, their avenues to move forward are very, very limited. And then you start taking TikTok away from them and things like that. And, you know, in there's the American context of the First Amendment. But I think if we look at the student movements all across the world, it is anti-establishment. And it's got legs, because George is right. This is about something. Go ahead, Martin.
Yeah, I mean, students, by definition, you know, are young and angry and are forming personalities themselves, are developing, and they tend to look for causes, you know, and you know, whether you have your meatball in your stew is big enough or not, or whether, you know, you're fighting for world peace. I think the parallels are interesting to what happened 60 years ago. If we look at Berkeley and Columbia, how these student protests actually made an impact, they were identified today by the so-called experts as really where it all began, where the thin end of the wedge of resistance and questioning and actually holding the establishment to account actually did finally result in America pulling out of Vietnam. If we compare to today now, we've got a slightly different situation in that in those days in the 60s, you had a feral press. You had a really independent, strong group of journalists, you know, who were felt it was their duty to be anti-establishment and to report on the Pentagon Papers and such forth. These days, I think the students have got more pressure on them. There's a bigger spotlight on them to make a difference, because they know that what's getting reported by the legacy media is not the truth. And, you know, so I think there's a real danger there for the elites that these movements could really mushroom into something. You know, they could be the only location, the only place you go to get any kind of acerbic commentary about what's going on in Israel and in America's role there. You know, it could be the last bastion, basically, of free speech. So, you know, watch this space very closely. I think between now and the new term starting, you know, it could be very interesting to see how big these protest movements are.
We do see the establishment, George, fighting back. This ridiculous bill that's going through Congress now has already been passed by the House, going to the Senate. Remember the Patriot Act? We all thought this is, you know, counter the First Amendment and Fourth Amendment. You know, I mean, this is on steroids right now. I mean, you and I have talked about this at quite length. I mean, it's absurd what is in that bill. It's absolutely absurd. And this is something that will be it's directed at educational institutions. But when you put something on the books like this, it gets very elastic. And just going back to the first part of the program, the powers that be have an enormous array of tools. Okay, they can take you out of the banking system like they did to the Canadian truckers. I mean, no. There is a difference between, you know, in the 60s, you know, they. Young men wanted to avoid the draft. They didn't want to go to Vietnam. That's the draft is not the issue right now. But I would say the threats against dissent are far greater now than it ever was in the 1960s. George.
Well, I agree completely. And that's why for such a movement to succeed, you would need really to mobilize as many of opponents of the powers that be of the establishment as you can. But what has emerged really within the last couple of weeks is that the populist right, which I think could easily make common cause with the students, with the protesters, because they themselves have been subjected to attack. You know, the populist right who were opposed to the war in Ukraine, who were opposed to COVID, opposed to the deep state, opposed to the crackdowns on free speech, could easily make common cause with them, because even if they don't necessarily agree with their view on the Middle East, they'll say, well, yeah, but, you know, they're against basically interventionism, getting into stupid wars and so on. But instead, they have now aligned themselves with the political establishment, with the forces of
world order. Establishment wins again.
That's right. And, you know, and so Trump who, you know, who could easily have just said, yeah, I'm kind of, you know, I have my sympathies with them. Instead said, yeah, yeah, let's start cracking heads. Let's call in the police. You know, why is the these university presidents not called in the police earlier? And that means that it is essentially they walked into a trap where you can just simply pick people off. You just call them fascists. So one day it's Trump and his supporters who are fascists. And then the next day it's the protesters of the university campus are fascists. So every day you're fighting against the fascist. And I think that's how you kind of pick off the opposition. So I think it was a great opportunity was missed in kind of forming some kind of an alliance.
Yeah, but Martin, it's really quite pathetic to watch because you see this unbridled use of force against primarily civilians in Gaza. And then the plethora of videos of young people being attacked by the police, particularly that situation at UCLA, which apparently looked like vigilantes allowed onto the campus here. I mean, the one thing they have, you know, we can look at protests and we can look at foreign affairs, but the powers that be, they're unrestrained in using violence. They're the ones using violence.
And it's going to continue, unfortunately. You know, I mean, I can't remember the university in America. You might remind me in the 60s where police actually opened fire with live rounds.
Hey, it's almost exactly the anniversary.
It is 54 years ago. Yeah.
So are we looking at a full circle now? Is that going to be the thing? You know, I mean, I think what George mentioned earlier about the crackdown, free speech, and how these countries develop into basically fascist regimes and aware. You know, though, like China or like any of these countries that we looked down on the last 30 years, you know, we've become like that now. And the free speech is going to be the real thing, which is going to be eroded completely. I'm wondering whether, you know, these student protests are going to be the perfect, the almost gift wrapped thing that the elites will shine the spotlight on and blame for everything. They'll be the scapegoats, you know, and I think I'm expecting already a lot of fake news, a lot of false flag attacks. You know, it's quite easy to stage demonstrations. You hire a few hundred mobs, a few hundred mobsters, you know, and youths, and whether they be right-wing nutters or whatever. I can see all this in the future. And I think I'm wondering whether student protests will be that. There will be the what they've been waiting for, you know, really something they can use and manufacture more fake news. And, of course, a great distraction. Drake was throwing
in this age of canceling, I mean, so George, particularly in the case of the United States, American youth will be canceled and there'll be justification for it. Okay. I mean, we criticize these elites till the cows come home, but you never can deny that they don't think big, George.
Exactly. And when you look at these universities, they're in the business of raising money. And for them, the only thing that matters is, you know, who's got the big bucks. And they look at the students, and they don't have big bucks. So
they're in debt.
Exactly, they're in debt. So, you know, if it's, you know, well, do I keep Bill Ackman happy or the politicians on Capitol Hill happy, or do I keep the students happy? It's no contest. They call in the cops. The interesting what you said, Peter, about the UCLA, because that wasn't vigilantes. It was a very well-staged occasion. And as the New York Times revealed the other day, that one of the financiers of this vigilante group at the UCLA was Jerry Seinfeld's wife. So you kind of get celebrity activism now on the side of cracking down on students, because they knew exactly what they were doing. They were going to cause violence, which then triggers a police response. And so now you have this, so the celebrities themselves, you know, suddenly discovering their Jewishness, these absolute multi-billionaires who have, you know, made these stupid jokes and stupid sitcoms over the years. Oh, they're so Jewish. They have to do what they can for Israel. So they crackdown.
I don't know what their identity is, but they're very, very rich, and the rich get what they want. Martin, we have to point out to our viewers that Southern California is Likud occupied territory. A lot of people don't know that, but the it's very strong, the Likud influence here. Last 20 seconds, go to you, Martin. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think on the student protest thing, the other thing that I found very interesting is that how a number of university campuses now have struck deals with the students. You know, one has agreed that the American UN secretary, the UN ambassador, doesn't speak at a conference that she was supposed to speak at. Another one has offered an Arab Cultural Center as
But the money is untouched. Okay,
exactly. Yeah.
It's all window dressing here. Unfortunately, gentlemen, the time always flies too fast. We've run out of time. I want to thank my guests in Budapest and in Marrakesh, and of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, crosstalk rules.